I am Edgar Sandman, and I teach in the theology department at Valparaiso University. And most of my teaching in the last 22 years there has been in the area of non-Christian religions. And I have done survey courses in non-Christian religions, probably three sections every semester since I've been there, and some special courses in Buddhism and in African traditional religions. And the reason I'm a bit suntanned is because I've been in Phoenix, Arizona for the last 5 months studying Native American religions, American Indians. And that's kind of the beginning of that one for me. Today, I want to speak about Baha'i. And again, following the custom of this people, I would like to begin with a prayer from the prophet Baha'u'llah. O thou kind Lord, thou hast created all humanity from the same stock. Thou hast decreed that all shall belong to the same household. In thy holy presence, they are all thy servants, and all mankind are sheltered beneath thy tabernacle. All have gathered together at thy table of bounty. All are illumined through the light of thy providence. O thou kind Lord, unite all. Let the religions agree and make the nations one, so that they may see each other as one family and the whole earth as one home. May they all live together in perfect harmony. This prayer, you can't miss the basic theme of Baha'i, the unity of God and the unity of all people. This theme of worldwide unity is one that comes through in every book title that comes from the Baha'i Publishing Company. The Earth is but one country, a book title. Baha'i, World Faith. Baha'u'llah and the New Era. Era of oneness. Foundations of world unity, religion for mankind, titles like that keep coming out, all emphasizing that same thing. How many of you have not known at all about Baha'i? How many of you have never heard of Baha'i? Everybody's heard of it. Not quite, okay. How many of you have known someone who was affiliated with Baha'i? Okay, quite a number of you. All right, the North American headquarters of the Baha'i faith is in Wilmette, Illinois, north of Evanston, just north of Evanston on the Chicago coast, northern coast there, Chicago, right close to the shore of Lake Michigan. It is the beautiful structure, the picture of which I have been passing around in these little folders. I hope they keep moving. It is a place that I have visited many times with my class. That is called the Baha'i House of Worship. There are four others of those in the world, only four others. They are in Frankfurt, Germany, Sydney, Australia, Kampala, Uganda, and in Panama City. I don't know for sure if that one is still, if it is completed yet. But these houses of worship are spaced throughout the world as monuments to the ideal that the Baha'i faith stands for. They are not primarily the meeting places of the people who are Baha'is, but they are a place of prayer for everyone and a place to inquire for everyone to inquire about the Baha'i faith. The world center of Baha'i is in Haifa, in Israel, and Mount Carmel, the slopes of Mount Carmel have many of their important buildings. The World Administrative Center is there on the slopes of Mount Carmel. The beautiful tomb of the one whom I will identify later, the Bab, and nearby there, the tomb of Baha'u'llah, and the archives where all the original copies of the sacred writings are kept. All of this is there at Haifa, on the slopes of Mount Carmel. Now, as I mentioned to those of you who were here yesterday, I cannot talk about Baha'i and tell you how it came into being without talking to you about a little bit more about Islam, because Baha'i came out of a particular aspect of Islam, out of Shia Islam. And the two great divisions within the Islamic world, the two larger divisions, are the Sunni and the Shia. We'll have to understand that a little bit in order to understand how Baha'is are coming out of that. Sunni and Shia. Now, with my apologies to people who were not here yesterday, I'm going to have to pick up at the point of the death of Prophet Muhammad in the year 632. And the community of Islam in the year 632 was faced with the question of how the Prophet Muhammad would be succeeded. First of all, we have to realize that he cannot have a successor in his role as prophet, for we mentioned yesterday, he is the seal of the prophetic line. There are to be no more prophets. But he had another hat that he wore, and that was the crown of the prince, the ruler of the earthly community of Muslim people, the one who acted as king, as judge, as the jury, as everything to interpret and apply the revelation of God, as the Quran now contains it, to apply that to all the situations of human life in the community of Medina, and by 630, he said, in the community of Mecca, and in the meanwhile, all the regions around that had come into affiliation also with the Prophet. So the community of Medina is now faced with the question of successor when Muhammad dies. And a group of inner circle companions of the Prophet chose from among their number a man who's, I'm going to move through this quickly so that you probably don't need to know the names of these successors, but Abu Bakr. And he was chosen without too much controversy, I think, because he was a very close companion to the Prophet. He ruled for 2 years when he died a natural death. The way of choosing a successor was through the will of the community, as the will of the community was expressed through some of their elders and some of their leaders. So that system was followed to choose the second leader, Umar. And Umar ruled from the year 634 to the year 644, about 10 years there, and there was lots of expansion of Islam during this time, moving way up north through the land of Canaan up into the Syrian region, Damascus, over eastward already through Iraq and into Persia by that time. So it's really been moving over into northern Africa already in the Egyptian area. After his death, which was an assassination by a slave in his household, who tradition tells us was a slave captured in Syria and was a Christian slave. After his death in 644, the community selected another leader, Uthman, and Uthman had a 12-year rule. Uthman's roots were back in Mecca. He was from one of the powerful families of Mecca, the Umayyad family. And he ruled these 12 years with a pretty heavy hand. And by the end of his rule, there was considerable discontent among the people, especially the people who were not of Arab descent, the people in the eastern regions of the of Persia especially. Well, during all this time, from 632 to 656, where we have these three rulers in there who are called caliphs, these caliphs were ruling, but there was an undercurrent of discontent and of resistance to them. And that had been there from the beginning, but it kept getting stronger and stronger, this resistance to the legitimacy of those three rulers. And the resistance centered around another name, Ali. Ali was a person who they believed should have been the first successor to the Prophet, those who were gathered and followed around him. In fact, Ali's supporters believed that God had designated Ali to be Muhammad's successor. And he was also in the bloodline, in the family of Muhammad. So his supporters firmly believed that anyone other than Ali was an illegitimate ruler. Now, by the time of the death of Uthman in 656, there was enough resistance to Uthman and his oppressive kind of rule that the supporters of Ali gained more and more and more strength. And so after the death of Uthman, it was quite clear that Ali was to be the fourth successor, or the fourth caliph. But as far as Ali's supporters were concerned, he was the first legitimate successor of the Prophet Muhammad. Well, Ali didn't last long, really, only 5 years in that rule, and all of those years were great turmoil. There was challenge to his taking over the rule from the household, from the family from which Uthman came. They had another one in their family that they meant to put in place, who was presently ruling in the region of Damascus. So there was conflict there, warfare. And Ali grieved over this tension, this split within the household of God. And finally, he decided to submit the matter of succession to a council of some kind, of respected people. And when he submitted to arbitration some of his more, I shouldn't use words like radical, but I guess maybe that's what we would usually say, some of his more radical supporters were so disillusioned that he, the choice of God, should let God's choice go up for arbitration, for human arbitration. And he was assassinated by one of his own followers for having compromised God's clear will in that way. At that point, the power of the Umayyad family took over again, and this regional governor from Damascus became the caliph, the single ruler of the whole Islamic family, which by that time had spread all the way over into India, all the way across North Africa, and throughout the whole Middle Eastern region. Now, that conflict is what gave rise to the division between Sunni and Shia. The word Sunni comes from Sunnah, which means custom or the tradition. Now, yesterday I mentioned, those of you who were here, the custom of the Prophet, the Sunnah of the Prophet, that is everything that was remembered that he did and said, applying the revelations to things, was eventually written down and became an authoritative statement for the communities of Islam. That's the Sunnah, the custom, the tradition. But during the time of these first three caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman, there was a continuing innovation all the time. That is, they also had to meet new situations and apply the revelation of the Quran to those new situations. The community of supporters of those three caliphs, those first three caliphs, believed that those caliphs were the rightly guided ones. That was the name that is given to them. That is, that God was giving them infallible guidance as they interpreted the Quran, or the revelation, and applied them to the community. So now we have the Quran, we have the Hadith, or the Sunnah of the Prophet, and we also have the Sunnah of these three rightly guided ones. And all of those, in that order of importance, are precedent for how the community of God's people should run. But, as you well imagine, the supporters of Ali did not support the Sunnah of the three rightly guided ones because they did not acknowledge them as legitimate at all. So, the name Sunni belongs to those who recognize not only the Sunnah, the custom of the Prophet, but also the customs established during the three caliphs. So they choose that name, the Sunni. The Shia are then the party that divided itself from the rest. And it means something like sect or offshoot or something like that, the word. So this marks the major division in the Islamic world. And today, when you read the newspapers, you'll be reading about a Sunni leader in this area and a Shia leader in this. Shia, as time went on, became strongest in the eastern regions, Iraq and Persia, now Iran, and still the form of Islam that dominates in those regions is Shia Islam. Now, what is really the difference besides that little conflict, that big conflict over succession? Well, it is a theological conflict already there, because it is a question of whether the successor to the Prophet must be, whether he has been designated by God, and whether God will continue to designate the leader of his community. So that is a theological difference from the beginning. The followers of Ali, of course, believe that it is divine designation that counts, and that it would be a kind of dynasty from there on, that in each generation, someone from the family of Muhammad would have the light as gift from God to lead the community in purity and in power. That is, Ali's supporters believed that Muhammad not only acted as a channel through which the revelation was received, and as one who was guided by God in ruling, but that he had a special divine light given to him to interpret the esoteric, the hidden meanings behind the literal words of the Quran. And that in each generation of leadership, that divine gift of illumination to interpret even the esoteric meanings of the Quran would be passed on to the rightful successor. So what we have here is a whole different idea of how that succession from the Prophet should come about and what it would be like. The Sunni would insist that the man is just a man chosen by the community. He does the best he can to take the literal knowledge of the Quran and the guidance that the scholars will give him and apply it to the community and that effect. Whereas she understands that God is actively guiding an infallible leader in every generation. So we have a series in Shion of 10, or a series of leaders called, yes, 12, leaders that come to be called imam. Now, imam is a word you'll find also in Sunni as prayer leader and so forth. But imam here is a special term that designated those successors to the prophet. Now, down through 10 generations, or 12 generations, I don't know why I'm stuck on 10 here, because it's obviously 12. Down through that many generations, we can name the imams, the rightful successors to the prophet. Of course, all they could do was to support those who were following them, because the real power in the world of Islam was in the hands of the Sunni. And the Shia really never had, for any length of time at all, if at all, the power to rule the whole world of Islam. But they went on as kind of a subgroup within Islam, always looking to a particular spiritual guide, an imam of their age. Till we come to the 12th imam. And the 12th imam, the succession fell to him when he was already just a little child yet. And he disappeared. And the story of the Shia is that he was taken away by God, hidden away, occulted away. He did not die, but he was taken away and hidden by God. And God would return this 12th imam to his people in God's own chosen time, at the end of time, when he was ready to usher in the renewal of his whole kingdom. So we have here the picture then of a spiritual leader, the imam, the 12th imam, taken away, who will come again someday. And he is referred to as al-Mahdi. Again, that word Mahdi is used in Sunni, and there are a lot of, but right now I think I'll just simplify this and say they look for a figure that I think in our tradition we would say a messianic figure, one who will come at the end of time and to usher in the perfect kingdom of Islam. And he would be the returned 12th imam. That's the setup for the beginning of today's lecture. Now, here we go. Interesting, however, just think of this messianic expectation. When does that come out in a religion? It comes out when a people is oppressed and don't believe that the real truth of God's plan is able to unfold. So it is in the exile of the Israelites that messianism really comes out, isn't it? When they're destroyed and they're down and out, and they look ahead with faith in the God who will restore. And so this messianic figure begins to take shape in that. So also in Islam, Shia, the minority group, the oppressed, they couldn't get the power that they thought was God's rightful plan. And so it takes the shape of a messianic figure. We have that repeated dozens of times, I think I've attempted to say hundreds of times, in the contemporary world, where tribal religions, after having received Christianity and feeling the oppression of colonial powers, have come up with a religion of messianism, that sort, looking for the time to come when justification from God will come, when the validation of the truth will really come then. We will have our day then. We don't have it now. Interesting thing to think about. It is then in that context of Persia where Shia and its expectation of the returning al-Mahdi, where that is a living and vibrant hope. When will he come? Like in Israel at the time of Jesus, everybody, when will he come? The deliverer us. When will the promised Messiah come? It's that sort of atmosphere that sets up the beginnings of Baha'i in Persia, 1850. 1844, to be more exact, we have an individual who comes to the fore and declares himself to in some way be connected with this expectation. He is one who is referred to the by the Baha'i people as the Ba'a. The Ba'a is the gate. The gate of God's guidance and to his community. And it comes very, very close to being a claim to be the Al-Mahdi, the returned one who will lead God's people in and restore the perfect kingdom of Islam. Comes very close to that kind of a declaration. He claimed to be a descendant of Muhammad, which would put him in line with this whole Shia idea of the succession being in the family of the Prophet. He claimed to be the primal point, or a primal point, and that was a technical term in Shia Islam, referring to the great prophets of the past, the ones who had begun new religion. So that means that there's a claim here to be the beginner of a new religion, in that sense, like the Prophet Muhammad. His claim includes the title Manifestation of God. And that was a title that had been applied back to the prophets. So the claim is a very, very strong one, though just a little bit ambiguous yet, in terms of this. But the Ba'a gathered followers quickly, and he spoke then in his preaching not only an interpretation that I'm not going to go into at this moment, but he also spoke of the one who is to come. And his vocabulary there sounds a whole lot like we're accustomed to hearing John the Baptist's vocabulary as he talked about the one who is here to point to the greater who is still coming. So the Ba'a, on the one hand, has the claim of being the beginner of a new religion, and on the other hand, is a kind of forerunner pointing ahead to one who is on the horizon already as the great son, and who eventually turns out, very soon turns out to be Baha'u'llah. The movement that began here then was called the Babis, the followers of the Ba'a. And it didn't last long, but he was executed in 1850 already, before a firing squad. The story that the Baha'is tell is that when he was to be executed, all these expert marksmen took their rifles, and he was tied to the post, and they took the order, they fired, and not a bullet hit him. And he stood there alone. After they recovered their composure and got new orders, they had a second round at it. Now, marksmen don't miss. The story is, of course, that God miraculously protected him from that first barrage of bullets as a testimony to the community of who he really was, that he was indeed a prophet of God. One of his early followers eventually kind of came to the fore as the leader of the group of the Ba'is, and he eventually takes the title Baha'u'llah. He is the one whose name is first and foremost in the Baha'i religion. The prophet of our era, Baha'u'llah. The story about his life I'll have to go over rather quickly here, I think, in order to... He and his fellow Babis were causing too much trouble in Persia. Now, the trouble they were causing is simply these kind of claims, like Jesus was causing trouble in his time, by people believing he was the Christ, the promised one. And that's a lot of trouble for the religious establishment as well as for the political establishment in a lot of ways. place. So it was the Shia government and institutional religion that waged a great persecution against the Babis in Persia. And they were exiled to Iraq, to the region of Baghdad. The kind of station that Baha'u'llah was claiming, and he was insisting on the primacy of the Ba'ath rather than Baha'u'llah, and somehow we have now a division between those who become the who are the Ba'athis and those who now begin to call themselves Baha'i, the Baha'i. This schism in the community, the early community of Baha'i, had a very great influence upon the rest of the Shaykh of Baha'i. Never again shall God's people be subjected to such schism. That was the determination, and from there on, the writings of the Prophet are filled with plans as to how that can be avoided, how the community can have one spiritual voice to lead it, and not be brought into confusion through schism. Well, the Babis were exiled someplace else, and the Baha'is were exiled over in the Tu'aqqa prison city near Haifa, and that is how the story of his line ends. For it ends there that he was in a kind of house, under a kind of house arrest, but he was functioning very well as the leader of a new religion in a great mansion there for many of those years, but he was technically still a prisoner of the Turkish Empire. And he died there in the year 1892, and that is celebrated by Baha'is as the ascension of Baha'u'llah. I mean, they do believe he died, but he was taken that to God. After the death, then, of Baha'u'llah in 1892, We have the question of how the thing shall be carried on, for he was clearly the authoritative voice. First the Baha, then the Baha'u'llah. Now what? Well, by will and testament, Baha'u'llah, his grandson, Abdul Baha, Abdul Baha, which means servant of Baha, the servant of his father, who is the glory of God, Allah. I didn't tell you that, did I? Meaning the title here, Allah, God, and Baha, glory. He is the glory of God. And so, servant Baha, Abdul Baha, servant of the glory. At one and the same time, servant of Baha'u'llah and servant of God. Baha'u'llah chose Abdul to be his successor in this respect only, that he was to be the sole interpreter of the teachings of the Bab and the voluminous writings of his father, Baha'u'llah. He was to be the final word on the true interpretation. See what I mean by how that schism shaped things? Never again shall there be a schism. Here we have the sole interpreter. But he was clearly not a new manifestation of God, not a primal point. He was not considered to be a prophet receiving new revelations, but only rightly guided by God to make clear and infallible interpretations. So he was the leader of the community then until his death at age 77 in 1921. And when he died, his grandson, that's where I got the grandson thing a while ago, his grandson Shoghi Effendi took over the leadership, and he was appointed by will and testament of Abdul as guardian of the cause, interpreter, and the one who would finally now bring the administrative order of Baha'i into its completion, so that there would be a council to make the interpretations. But in a sense, we have a succession here of individuals who are infallible, and finally we will have a council of nine that provide the infallible ex cathedra kinds of statements and interpretation leadership. So the experience of schism in that early history really took hold and shaped, I think, a lot of us. Well, what is all of this about? The purpose of God, according to Baha'i, is to bring the human race into higher and higher levels of development, of spiritual development. There is a kind of spiritual evolution of all mankind that is going on, toward that goal that God has in mind of unity with Him, humanity in unity with Him, the human race in love with God and in communion with God and in unity with each other. That is God's vision for the world. And that vision of God has been unfolding in a kind of evolutionary manner in the course of the history of human civilizations. As human civilization has moved from tribalism and millions of languages to nation states, which is a little larger unit, and now we have come into the new era of God's plan, where we must rise beyond nation states and think of ourselves as one humanity, one world people, one family, all those things that were implied by us. So a world community, a world language, and as an instrument, and one world religion, that is following Baha'u'llah, universal education for all people, for in that education there is freedom and enlightenment toward this unity, understanding. The world government and world judiciary, all of that will finally emerge in this era. How long this era is, we don't know. But it has been ushered in, a new era of God's plan. And it has been ushered in with a prophet and a message that supersedes the former messages of the prophets. They were true in their time, for their circumstances, for which, and the purposes for which God had brought those prophets. But now, in our time, as God moves his humanity into another stage of that spiritual evolution, he has sent the prophet with the latest as guidance and spiritual guidance and message. There is a newness in his message, but there is at the same time a confirmation of all the eternal truths that the previous prophets had brought. Alright, so I'm speaking then about God's long-range plan for his creatures, humanity, as he brings them from their smallest development as communities of tribes into finally a world community, as he brings them from lower and more simple knowledge of him into larger and larger knowledge of God and communion with God. And so they see themselves as part of God's plan through history, participating with him in bringing in this new era of oneness. I speak of this as spiritual evolution of humanity, and in that evolution there is progressive revelation, new revelation for each era. Now quickly, living the Baha'i faith. I would say that accepting the vision that I've tried to set forth here, accepting the vision, is becoming a Baha'i. Formally, you declare that. You go to a local community of Baha'is to declare your conviction that Baha'u'llah is the prophet for a new era and that his teachings are your vision. You accept his teachings. You become a Baha'i that way, or else if there is no local community, you write to the national headquarters and they will help to give you a chance to identify yourself with that vision of the Baha'i. To grow in the vision is to be studying the writings, especially of Ibn and Baha'u'llah, as well as the interpretive writings of Abdul Baha and Shoghi Effendi. These are, in a sense, all like sacred scripture. And to study with the interpretations of Baha'u'llah, the scriptures of the Old Testament, New Testament, Quran. You go to a temple service of the well-met, they may read from the Bhagavad Gita of India, but they believe that even Krishna was one of these prophets of God. The Buddha was one of these prophets of God from the Baha'i perspective. And they read, like to read from any of the scriptures of the world in that service around a particular theme, usually a theme of unity or love, something like that. So in a sense, all are affirmed, but all of the others need to be surpassed now, as God has brought in a surpassing revelation. So to grow in the vision is to study the scriptures, to share in the community and fellowship with prayer of other Baha'is in house meetings, where they study and pray, and to keep certain feast days and fasting and prayer. They have that whole schedule of liturgical evangelism, which we call it. And then there is the matter of sharing the vision. So I talk about accepting the vision and sharing the vision. The Baha'i people are, in one sense, very low-key about this. Reminds me of a statement from a Hindu guru who says, God is not in a hurry. And in a sense, Baha'is are willing to accept that, because God is not in a hurry. So what shall we do? We shall identify ourselves with God's vision. We will share that vision wherever we can, in every way we can, but we will not force the issue. For in the coming being of the new era, the era of Baha'u'llah, there will have to be a gradual disintegration of the present orders of society.
The way we, with our nation states, have our world organized and handle our world problems, that will all have to fail on its own account. It's like dying. The old era is done. And the Baha'i faith stands there with the plan, the revealed plan, for how that structure, those structures, will be superseded by a new structure, a new world administrative order. But you do not force the issue. When civil rights was right up front like this, my classes would talk to the Baha'is about, what do you say about that here in Chicago? What about justice and freedom and for black people and things like this? What do Baha'is do about that? And basically the answer was nothing but to show love. And all this conflict in society, they are not to align themselves with the parties, with political parties, with power groups of any kind. For all of those power groups are on the side of the old order. But they are to quietly show love and move ahead into the new era with the message of God. That was very disappointing for some of our students who wanted a more active and religiously inspired role in change. Well, I suggested that there is, all right, the one thing then for sure, the vision is the fireside chats. Maybe some of you have heard about those. They're advertised in newspaper clippings all the time in big cities. A fireside get together in somebody's house where several Baha'is invite others to come in and talk about what the faith is. So that seems to be almost an institutionalized way of spreading the faith. And another is the practice of pioneering, where Baha'is will do something like what I think most of us know Mormons do. That is to commit several years, young people especially tend to do this, to commit several years of their lives to go into a part of the world or a part of our country where there is no Baha'i assembly, where there are a few, if any, Baha'is at all, and simply to take up residence there, to take work there enough to support themselves, and to be kind of a living testimony of what Baha'i is there, and trying to get enough people in to establish another local spiritual assembly there. So pioneering, giving several years of life into what we would, I suppose, call traditionally a formal missionary work, being present with the vision. The administrative structure then is local spiritual assemblies, national spiritual assemblies, and then the world spiritual assemblies. And I don't think I need to go into all of the things that make up that order. Just one final word. If you watch your news magazines, you know, of course, that there is a lot in these magazines nowadays about the persecution of the Baha'is under the Khomeini regime. 300,000 Baha'is in that country are under tremendous pressure, and a large number of them executed. I'm sure that a Buddhist, a Hindu will get along a lot better in Iran today than Baha'i, because the Shia government of Iran sees the Baha'is as a heretical group of Islam. Those who had the heritage of Islam and have betrayed it. And that's even different from being of another religion. They're harsher on that. So it's a very severe kind of persecution. Now that's all I'm going to say, and I'm going to be very long to come back at me, because I had to do that Shia Sunni thing in order to tell you where the division comes from.
Yeah. How big is the Baha'i movement worldwide? Does it fit in
the
world class with Islam?
Numerically, it can't begin to. Now, of course, as a movement, it's less than, about a century old. About one century old. They are in 300 and some different countries. They speak of some, I wrote down some numbers here. As far as absolute numbers of persons they consider Baha'is, I don't even have a figure on that. I look for it, I can't find it. In 50,000 different localities in the world, 12,000 actual official local spiritual centers. I don't know.
Probably a little bit bigger.
I think it's a significant movement in world religions. I don't see it as something that, you know, just comes on the scene and fades away. I think it's shown itself to be too powerful for that. Vision is too attractive in a way to a war-torn world. And I don't know if we're just fade away like the thumb of my head. All
right. Where are the Bobbies?
What?
Bobbies?
No, they, that group of the Bobbies that split off became extinct shortly thereafter, as far as we know. I don't think they lasted very long.
What was the symbolism? Weren't there nine doorways to the temple?
Yes, there are nine sides to all the houses of prayer. I've asked that once, I've asked that 100 times, and it's the best answer I can get is it's the largest single digit available to suggest unity. But I'm not satisfied. I've tried really to get the Baha'is to answer that question, and they that's the only answer I can get is a nine single digit and suggests oneness.
Do the Baha'is pray five times to Mecca?
No, they do not have prayers facing Mecca. They do not consider themselves Muslims. And Islam certainly does not consider them Muslims. But they came out of that vision. But they have a requirement, three prayer times a day. It's a little bit less regimented. It's not a structured ritual prayer as the Islamic prayers are. A little bit more brief form, although there are certain prayers of Baha'u'llah that are urged to pray each day. There is a fast in the month, parallel to a 19-day fast, parallel to the Ramadan, and corresponds to the 19 days when he was in the garden making his declaration. Yes, in principle, Baha'i would leave itself open to the fact that when this vision of God has been brought to a certain level of completion, a new prophet could indeed arise. That may be many centuries from now.
Do they have a
dream
of paradise?
Yes, they do. A very interesting one, but when you die, your soul, body separated, and your soul carries with it the spiritual development of your lifetime, whether that be much or little. And then there is a continuation of that spiritual development in the world beyond, toward more and more knowledge and communion with God. If you come through this life indifferent toward religion, love of God, you've had your hell already. For to be apart from the knowledge of God and apart from communion with God is hell. And so after death, you simply are behind in that spiritual development. But it can still occur through the prayers of the living in this world and through the spiritual assistance of those who have gone before. You still may be brought into that growing communion with God, which has no end. So there's not a heaven as a place, but there is the belief in a continuing condition in which you grow more and more into the knowledge of God and the joy of that union with God. There's no end to that. But it's interesting that the prayers of the living and the guidance of those who've gone before is involved in that thought. I don't know. I don't immediately see the pearl.
I read that Thomas Merton was very interested in Eastern religions. Do you know if the Baha'i was one of them?
The what?
Thomas Merton was very interested in Eastern religions, was Baha'i one of them? To my knowledge, it was not, but I haven't read nearly all of Thomas Merton's things. But what he was really interested in is the Eastern.
believer of another faith would just be of a lower spiritual development rather than excluded from the kingdom.
That's right. That's right. So in that sense, you're very open and very tolerant. And it does also remind me of that move that I suggested before from the Hindu guru. God is coming to earth. Neither are they. But they're busy. And their life has meaning. Their life has meaning because their life is joined to God's long-range purposes for this world. That's what finally makes anyone's life worthwhile.
But there's no end to reincarnation.
No, I don't think so. Although I guess I've puzzled about that a couple of passages here and there, that whether there might be some hint of reincarnation, but I don't think I can say that there is.
That was my question about reincarnation.
Now, if somebody knows something about that, please share it. I pursued that a little, and I can't.
It would be conscientious objectors, then?
I think so, but I'm not positive whether they're altogether consistent about that. But in principle, they shouldn't be, because they are not to align themselves with the support of any particular order. Although, there are principles and guidelines for maintaining the basic order and welfare of society while this transition goes on. That is, the weak need to be protected from the gross. And indeed, do need a kind of guardianship of the well-being. Yes, they're not supposed to vote in the political process because that's participating in the old order. Let it die. Are others?
What's the problem about Sufi?
That's a good question. But the Sufi, which is a mystical movement in Islam, I don't know that I can say he was, but there certainly are a lot of Sufi themes that come through his writings. Now, one of the things, I'll let you go in a second because I think it is time to adjourn. One of the things that I must say has been most difficult for me as I try to be sympathetic and favorable and appreciative of any religious vision I talk about, to give it its very best shot, I have very much trouble with the way Baha'i handles the historical faith of Judaism, Christianity, and the scriptures. And when I read in Baha'u'llah's writings the way he takes the certain promises of the prophets of the Old Testament and words of Jesus, and the way he understands those in a totally non-historical way, or so totally out of their setting, that I get very nervous as very historically oriented student of scripture. So it does bother me the way they handle that. But I think you at least see something of the vision. If any of you want to pursue further questions with me, you're welcome to. I'll stick around.